This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Figures from the National Sexual Violence Resource Center show 20% of women and about 6% of men are sexually assaulted in college. These cases often make headlines, such as the controversial sentencing of Stanford University student Brock Turner, who received a six-month jail term for sexual assault. And here to talk about campus sexual assault and the university policy surrounding it, our Chief Title IX Officer at Xavier University's Title IX Office, Kate Lawson, Deputy Title IX Coordinator and Sexual Assault Response Coordinator at Miami University's Title IX Office, Becca Getson, and President of Thomas More College, David Armstrong. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Kate, Becca, and David, thank you for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you for having us.
Happy to be here.
So, David, start us off. What is Title IX, and then what does it have to do with sexual assault on campus?
Sure. I'm here today able to talk about it because whether luckily or unluckily, I was in the center of the perfect storm at Notre Dame College in Cleveland back in 2005 and dealt with the Department of Education and the confluence of an old law, which was the Jean Cleary Act, Campus Safety Act, and the confluence of then Title IX brought into those things together. Jean Cleary Act was a Consumer Protection Act. It was about colleges giving consumer information on crime statistics and crimes that happen on their campus. And then Title IX is more about sex discrimination. So the U.S. Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights enforces, among other statutes, Title IX of the Education Amendment of 1972. Title IX protects people from discrimination based on sex in education programs or activities that receive federal financial assistance. The law states, no person in the United States shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from, participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any education program or activity receiving federal financial assistance. So Title IV funding goes across the board for K through 12 colleges. Anybody that's receiving dollars from the education department is under this law. You may have heard Title IX before talked about athletics, giving opportunity for women in athletics. And now you see Title IX used more in dealing with sexual harassment, sexual assault, and those items on campus.
Kate and Becca, as far as Title IX, does David have it right?
He does. Well done, David.
Thank you so much.
Yeah,
that was a good explanation.
Absolutely. Very thorough. Right. So just to emphasize, the way we get to sexual assault and the reason we've had such an implosion of conversation about student-on-student sexual violence across the country over the last 5 years is really under this umbrella term of sex discrimination, which filters down to sexual harassment being a form of sex discrimination. And then the Department of Education has been very clear that sexual assault and rape are the most severe form of sexual harassment. So that's how we arrive at this phenomenon, sexual assault. And we have cases around Stanford, Florida State, et cetera, where we're hearing so much about Title IX and the processes that we're required to do as institutions that receive federal funding.
Mm-hmm. How big of an issue is this, Becca? How seriously are colleges and universities taking this?
I think they're taking it incredibly seriously. I think it's on the top of a lot of schools' priorities in regards to both responding to cases, but also working to prevent those cases from happening in the first place. There's a lot of legislation now that's also out about how to respond, but also how to prevent, whether that's bystander training, providing information about risk reduction, whatever that may be. So I think both that response piece, but also that prevention piece is very high on the radar of a lot of universities to make sure that they're taking care of all their students.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've heard that there's been an increase in reports of sexual assaults on campus. Any thoughts on why there's been an increase? Is it a case of more are actually occurring, or is it just that people are more aware and the reporting rates themselves are going up?
Sure. So the way that we view it, and looking at climate surveys, both our own and also across the nation, we are not seeing an increase in the number of incidences, but rather an increase in the number of reports. And we actually consider that a good thing. And the more people report, the safer they feel in our community, in our campus, to make that report, and they aren't doing this alone. So not necessarily that there's an increase in incidences, but we think that that increase in reporting is actually a really, really good thing, that we're getting information out there, that we're providing the help and support that they need in order to report those incidences that are happening.
And as a president who reports to a board, It's something that you have to educate your board about, because if you're doing a good job with your Title IX compliance and your campus safety, you are going to get more reports. And that's a good, like Becca said, that's a good thing. Yet board members or people that are looking at your institution will say, wait a minute, what's going on at this school because there's more reports? No, it's the fact that we're educating people better. They understand the policies and procedures, and people are coming forward to make sure that they're protected.
Yeah, David, as a parent, I'd have to ask the question, and when I hear this, how safe is my child when they go off to school? How do you reassure parents?
That's a great point, because, and that happens. You go to any orientation, Xavier, Miami, Thomas More, any school, that's one of the first questions that comes up from the parents. Here's what I tell them. I say, listen, you've done a great job at home. We're going to continue working with you on that. In the end, it does come down to the student. We will do all we can to educate them, but then they have to make right choices, and we will work with them throughout that process. For us to sit here and say nothing's ever going to happen to you and put you in a bubble, it's false. So we will be very upfront and talk about what are the challenges, what we have to do, and what we have in place to make sure. The tough part is you have young people, sometimes under the influence of alcohol or drugs, that are making bad choices. That's the tough part.
At Xavier, we try to take a really proactive approach, just like at Thomas More and Miami, by engaging with parents and prospective students and families ahead of them coming to campus to say, listen, gender-based violence, including sexual violence, this is a public health epidemic. We know that it happens. And instead of saying it doesn't happen here, which I think any school these days would have to be asleep in front of the wheel to say that, instead we say this is an issue that impacts students' educational lives, which is what we care about, and here's our plan to address it. So we're having these proactive conversations with parents. I always say, as a parent of two little boys, the first school I want my kids to go to is not the school that's saying, not happening here, you're perfectly safe, but instead is saying, we know this is an issue, and here is how we're addressing it proactively through bystander engagement, having a conversation with the Title IX coordinator, really strong visibility and leadership. That's the way I think we can best engage with parents and prospective students.
Mm-hmm. And Becca at Miami?
Same thing. At orientation, we actually do a session called Community Expectations, where we not only talk to our incoming students, but also our parents. And we share that exact same information with them as well. So those parents and caregivers that come, and we talk about what the expectations are for their student on campus. And one of those segments is about sexual and interpersonal violence, what that looks like on our campus, how they might be able to help as well, and that this conversation can be happening before they get to campus, while they're on campus. We want to share our messaging with them as well so that they can help us reinforce that, so that that conversation is not just happening during our 30, 40, 60-minute presentations, but also among friends, among parents and family members as well.
So how do you define sexual assault, sexual misconduct, Becca? What constitutes that?
So it depends on if you're asking from the law perspective or from campus. So there are actually two different definitions depending upon.
Now, sexual misconduct would be the campus term, right?
Yes. Okay. Yep. So on Miami's campus, we use sexual misconduct, and that's a much broader range than what is considered sexual assault in terms of the legal definition of it. So when we have a case of sexual misconduct on our campus, it may or may not meet the legal definition. And we actually don't look at the legal definition for whether or not we're going to move forward on a case of sexual misconduct. What we're looking at is, has a student violated our student code of conduct? And we're looking at that as opposed to a criminal code violation.
Mm-hmm. Which gets to the biggest issue right now in the public is that people hear about the Stanford case and they're calling it the Stanford case, and really it's not the Stanford case. That was a criminal case against Brock Turner brought by the state of California. And as far as I know, and Kate and Becca can correct me, I have not seen that Stanford has taken any action in this case, that this was completely a criminal situation. And so there's the difference between criminal, which you have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, and things that happen on campus that have to prove by a preponderance of the evidence, which is if you say 51.
Which is a lower standard.
A lower standard. And so colleges now, and this is again the debate, is colleges have to be, are involved in these types of very tough cases, and people are saying that we're not prepared. Government's saying that we have to be prepared to handle that. And then you have criminal situations. And so some of the times I feel that we should be spending a lot more time fixing the criminal justice system when it comes to sexual assaults and rape and those kind of things. And all the time that we're spending on college campuses, the more interesting case right now to me is the Baylor case. That's a systemic issue that this college, either the claims are that they covered things up, that they did not have a good system, that they ignored complaints. Now, that's an issue for us from an education standpoint.
And you had two university officials disciplined in that,
Ken Starr that had to resign, and the football coach had to resign. And actually, there's several other firings within the school because these complaints allegedly were not handled. As a former assistant to the prosecutor who had over 70 trials, I always try to explain to people, there's this story on the far right, there's this story on the far left, somewhere in the middle lies the truth. And that's a tough thing to deal with. But when those burdens of proof are different for the evidence, it makes it – and again, the general public doesn't always understand why we may have a finding of sexual misconduct where then a criminal case in the same case happens and the person is found not guilty. Well, how did the school have it? Well, it's a different level of evidence.
I would just add, you know, thinking about, I think that conflation of the Title IX process and the criminal process is one of the continuing challenges for universities to explain in an accessible way to students and parents and the campus community the difference between those two systems. I think, you know, building off of what David said, you know, I think there's been a very well-deserved, in my opinion, spotlight on higher education's response to sexual violence over the last five or so years. I think what's interesting about the Stanford case is that it really appropriately, I think, broadened the spotlight to the criminal justice system and its response to sexual violence and our broader cultural response, because we got to hear, you know, the father, the friend, the prosecutor. It really was sort of a perfect
right.
story. Of opinions. And I think what it revealed to a far wider audience than I think had been exposed or was interested in engaging, frankly, in this topic before are the issues and factors that make the most common form of sexual violence, which is acquaintance sexual violence, when the two people know each other. What are the sort of unique and I would say uniquely problematic issues around the position of this issue in our culture? So widespread lack of education on what it is, how to identify it, pervasive victim blame and social stigma through all systems, criminal justice, Title IX, family systems, friend systems, social systems, right? So I think what the Stanford case did, if there's any silver lining to a truly heinous crime, it's that I think people who sort of the broader culture or folks who were not engaged in this conversation looked up and said, now, wait a minute, that doesn't seem right. And so having a little bit of spotlight on all systems really, I think, can help move the needle on the actual issue, which I assume we could all agree on, which would be to have less perpetration of gender-based violence and more accessing services, including reporting.
So should universities be involved in this? Should this bypass the university level, go directly to the police?
So I've spoken nationally on this issue a lot. I know Kate's been around. We've had a couple sessions that we've done together. I know I've seen Becca at some sessions. You can really get deep into this conversation. There are those out there that say this is completely a criminal issue and this should be handed over to criminal authorities. But then you see the situation like you had in the Stanford case, which I think we would all agree seemed very inappropriate for the actions taken, again, if we know all the facts. So that is a great challenge. The federal government's making it clear. So we could sit here and debate it all day whether we should or we shouldn't, but the federal government has made it clear is that we are and that we will take care of that. And so I always try to give people the advice that, you know, we could sit here and debate it, but it really doesn't matter at this point. The federal government has their hands on that financial aid, and therefore we have to comply. So what I always tell people is, number one, create a campus culture of compliance through policy, procedure, and training, and it must start at the top. Okay, you must have the president of the institution, the board behind the institution to make sure that you become a compliance university, in the words of Peter Lake from Stetson Law. Continuous education and training and utilize resources and experts. And Peter Lake was one of the guys I was talking about. Utilized him at Stetson University and his Center for Excellence in Higher Ed Law and Policy. And that's not going to guarantee that you're going to be – that you're going to stop everything, but that's where you start. And so again, people will question whether or not colleges and universities should be involved with this. From a legal standpoint, people are questioning whether the OCR, as an administrative agency, has the power to be, you know, judge, jury, and executioner when it comes to these things. My concern is that most of the work of the OCR is done ex post facto. It's after the fact. I would much rather see the federal government coming forward and telling us exactly what they want, how we need to do it, and move forward. Now, some people will say there's unfunded mandates. So be it. But to me, in the end, it makes our college campuses safer and better, and that's, in the end, what we're trying to strive to do.
Can I just add, I get that question a lot, and in sort of state and city and national conversations, when I hear that idea of, you know, should schools be involved in, you know, what are schools doing in the business of prosecuting sexual assault cases? What I always try to raise is, it's interesting to me, we're not in the business of prosecuting sexual assault cases. We're doing what we've done for years,
well,
which,
like David said, it's the student conduct code.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Which we apply and adjudicate around all different kinds of conduct, including things that are criminal in nature and that would result in suspension or expulsion, drug distribution, physical fights. And what I think is interesting, what I try to push back on a little bit, is there's been no shred of outrage or not even raised eyebrow that we've been doing this work around these issues. So I think we'd be remiss if we don't always tie the conversation back to say, why so much concern on this issue? And I would argue it's because of the cultural position of this issue and that pervasive misunderstanding and misinformation. You know, one of the things that I talk about quite a bit when I hear that question is, when I hear someone say, why don't they just report to the police? Isn't that the right system? What that says to me is that the person very likely has not supported someone who has survived acquaintance sexual violence through the criminal justice system, because it's a pretty tough process. And then even when you make it through,
well, it's also public too. If you mm-hmm. once you start that process, you lose any confidentiality, right?
Somewhat. I think there's some protection around confidentiality, like, for example, the Stanford victim's name. But what's not protected is the fact that in many criminal processes, we look at the victim as opposed to looking at the perpetrator, or the accused individual. So that person's private life, as we read in the Stanford victim's statement, they came after her. Every medication, every cheating, whatever it was, her personal life was really attacked. Her sexual history, all of that. That's very unique to this issue. So I think a lot of people try to say, why isn't it treated like every other crime? And it's very important that we talk about the fact that it most definitively is not, pretty much in every which way you can think of.
I think part of that goes back to education.
That's
about
right.
The differences between what a university does versus what a criminal process does and what those different things look like. When I have these conversations, a lot of times people are like, why didn't they get jail time? It's a code of conduct violation. Uh-huh. The worst we can do to someone is dismiss them from the institution. That's the worst possible thing we could do to anybody. So that education around not only what does the university do, but also what does that criminal process look like and things like that to differentiate the two, so that the society as a whole is aware of what that is.
Now, go ahead, David.
I had the unique experience at Notre Dame where, for the first time in the history of the country, our dean of students at that institution was arrested for failure to report a felony because we were trying to go through our processes on campus, and we had a local prosecutor who said, well, no, you're not allowed to go through this process. And I said, well, wait a minute, didn't you go to law school? You know, supremacy clause, this is federal law. They said, we're going to put you in jail if you go through this process. And so not only did my first dean of students, who was in a situation that we had, go to jail, they threatened my second dean of students to go to jail. And so in the Dear Colleague letter in April of 2014, there's a line in there about that the federal government, that the local governments have to allow us to do our reviews and go through our process. And that was actually put in because of our experience up in Cleveland, Ohio. And so there's always this challenge between criminal, institutional, and our conduct codes on campus. And the last thing I'll say is that for us at Thomas More College, we've changed our code of conduct to make it more aspirational. It's no longer now, do not do this, do not do that. This is the behavior that we value. And when you go against that behavior, then we're going to have concerns. And so as a values-based institution, that's where we're heading with this. But we still have to follow all the federal government guidelines and procedures that we do.
So step me through the process. How would a victim file a report at, say, at Xavier? What would be the steps they would take there, Kate?
Sure. So the sort of entry point to making an official report to the Title IX office, there can be steps before that. But if someone wants to come directly to me as the Title IX officer there, what that person's going to hear from me is a lot of information so that they can understand their options, their rights, really get what they need to make an informed decision. We know that experiencing sexual assault in particular can be a very disempowering, can feel out of control. So what we try to do in our engagement with students when they walk into the office, from the physical setup to the meeting time through the conversation, is really to give them back as much information as possible so that they can decide what is best for them and make informed decisions. I can tell you that in my experience, students who have been sort of pushed into, you know, report to the police or report to Title IX, that typically long-term ends up being even worse for that student because they've been out of control of yet another process in their life. So what they'll hear is their ability to participate in Xavier's sex discrimination complaint resolution process. And they'll hear about what that looks like in terms of a Title IX investigation and then our conduct process. What's interesting, and I'm sure Becca and David will comment on this, is that while Title IX gives us these general mandates, and I think what can be confusing for students and the community is that schools can meet those requirements through a lot of different structures and systems that can look pretty different but still be compliant, if you will. So for Xavier students, they're going to hear about what are the interim measures that we can put in place during this process to ensure, you know, as much to shore up your safety, your well-being, your academics. We're going to offer confidential advocacy, which I am not, right at the start so that that person has someone to really support them fully throughout the process in all steps they want to take, which may end up being criminal, Title IX, or you know what? I need help in my biology class because I haven't been able to sleep for 5 days. Well, that's part of our work as well. So there's really a broad spectrum. If we decide to go through a Title IX investigation and the full complaint resolution process, then what that process asks and answers in a lot of different ways at different schools is there sufficient evidence to conclude that it's more likely than not, which is the preponderance of the evidence standard, that a policy violation has occurred. So that gets us to a finding and then whatever the sanction might be for whatever is the violation.
So how do you weigh the rights of the accused and the accuser if they're both students?
Well, the federal government is now understanding, because when they first came out with this confluence of Title IX and campus safety, it was definitely more on the complainants' side, and now they saw that the respondent was being treated somewhat unfairly, and now you have rules for the respondent and the complainant, and that you have to, now, and this is the tightrope. I always talk about walking the tightrope as an institution. You have to walk the tightrope of taking care of your student on this side, taking care of your student on this side, and following all the federal procedures on the other side. And for private schools, you know, the court's not going to look at – it's going to look at it. Did we give notice and did we follow our policies and procedures? So you have to follow your policies and procedures. And so it is a very thin line that we have to walk to make sure that the whole process is fair and that we do what we have to do under the policies and procedures.
Yeah, I think what I'd also add to that is there might also be a police component in terms of a crime alert. So what happens at Miami is that it kind of goes to two places as soon as we receive a report. Wherever that report is from, it'll come to my desk and it'll also come to our police department. And they'll make a determination about whether or not there needs to be a crime alert put out to help the campus be more aware of what's going on, safety, things like that. So that is their decision whether or not that meets the requirements. But then from there, it's very similar to what Xavier does in regards to making sure our first priority is safety. Does that person have what they need to be safe? Physically, emotionally, psychologically, and what kind of things can we do? And then also, what are the next steps in the process?
And so when you issue the crime alert, are you weighing how serious this is and how serious an issue it is to the campus safety?
Absolutely. Yeah. So there's several factors that they go to. Seriousness, time. So if this is something that was happened a month ago, that doesn't have that immediate incidence that may require an immediate crime alert to go out, but they might put it somewhere else. They might put it as a warning online, but it may not go out in one of our campus alerts that go out to everyone through everything. So it really depends, but primarily what they look at is the seriousness of the incident.
Mm-hmm. Can I just add, I think on this, the question, which I think is really a big part of the national dialogue, this question of balancing the rights of the parties, I think what I would add is, you do it intentionally and with vigilance and not in a vacuum. I think the tightrope is such a great analogy or metaphor for the work. I always say, if you're a person who likes things like black and white and easy decisions and checkboxes, this is not the job for you. This work, if I'm comfortable, I think I might be doing something wrong. So I'm pretty much uncomfortable in that tension. There needs to be a tension, a careful, well-informed balancing every case in every situation. Under Title IX, we're asked to have a prompt and equitable process to resolve these complaints. And I think sometimes folks hear equitable as equal, but in fact, equitable means fair under the circumstances. And that requires careful analysis that doesn't lend itself to checkboxes or in this case X, in that case Y. Instead, you really need to have people in these positions doing this work who have extensive training, experience, and a skill set that allows them to make these decisions in a way that, in fact, meets Title IX, is trauma-informed, as we're asked to be, and protects the rights of both parties and moves us through the process in a way that does that.
Another key factor, too, is retaliation. You have to make sure that you have a process that protects any complainant from retaliation, whether by inadvertent or purposeful retaliation from anyone involved in the process. And a lot of times you'll see a case bounce back because there's been retaliation to a complainant after they've come forward on a complaint.
So, David, what are some of the specific programs you have in place at Thomas More in terms of maybe courses that you offer during orientation, buddy systems, online resources, campus resources? What kinds of specific things do you have in place for fighting this?
Everything that you just said we have and we all should have and need to have. And so bystander training, the first thing we do is orientation. The second that student we consider on our campus, there's educational training for parents and students on Title IX, campus safety, Cleary statistics, all those things. We have that. Then we do tabletop exercises. We do plays. We do anything that we can to get the questions out, videos. Our campus, we have – every employee has to watch videos and check off all the information, and you won't get paid if you haven't done that. And so and then once the students are on campus, it's continuous training through student life. We educate our faculty. We educate the whole community. It's just constant vigilance on training. As Kate said, it never stops. You stay on top of it, vigilant, and keep on moving forward. Again, for the betterment of your campus. That's what it's all about in the end.
Beck and Kate, same thing in Miami and Xavier, I take it, as David was saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we also do some online programming as well. We try to do some targeted approaches as well. So we have additional training for our Greeks, additional training for our athletics, primarily because they have incoming classes that are really easy to access. So we also do our introductory courses. We have a University 101 class that we have a section on bystander and a section on sexual interpersonal violence, so that students are aware of what those resources are, aware of what is and isn't against the code, and things like that. So it's really broad. There's a lot of puzzle pieces to this kind of broader campaign that I think we all have, just to make sure that we are meeting all the students where they need to be met.
But I think, what you can hear loud and clear is that the days of like, hey, here's a pamphlet on this, you'll never talk about it again, are gone. It's really, I think all of us are stepping back to say, how are we integrating this, this prevention messaging, especially around the bystander? Because the truth is that 95% of the community does not engage in this behavior. And yet we have, you know, these incredibly high numbers. So how are we mobilizing and leveraging the 95% of us who don't engage in this behavior better to speak up, to stand up, to say what our community expectations are, and then to call people out when they're not, you know, early and often, so that it becomes a social norm instead of the social norm to look the other way. Oh, that's not my business. You know, I don't want to get involved. Instead, to have the social norm be to engage. So it's really, as you heard, and same at Xavier, it's really thinking multiple dosage, multiple entry points, meeting students where they are, and then integrating the topic where they are already, student clubs, organizations, in their courses. And I feel very lucky to be at Xavier because we really utilize the mission, right? So men and women in and for solidarity with each other to really drive that message so that students can't say, oh, I believe in the mission, but in this area, you know, not so much. So we're really trying to combine those prevention-wise.
Okay. And I think what's important to note about that is that it's really – there is no one answer for this. Right. There is no one campaign that we can say, here, do this, and we're good to go. It's really dependent on every university. I mean, it's even dependent sometimes on our different regional campuses for what that group of students and what that society and community expects and what they need versus a different community. So what Miami needs may not be what the other universities need. So much as we can learn from each other is great, but then we have to tailor it to each university and each individual campus.
Well, thank you for joining me this afternoon. Deputy Title IX Coordinator and Sexual Assault Response Coordinator at Miami University's Title IX Office, Becca Getson, and President of Thomas More College, David Armstrong. Kate will join us in the second part of the show as we look at programs that work directly with the survivors of sexual assault. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.